How much do you know about your right to keep and bear arms on a historical basis? Find out more today on Principles and Policies. Hello, I'm your host today, Chuck Michaelis, the Vice Chairman of the Institute for Principled Policy and the Executive Director of Camp American. Well, once again, we are bringing you a show about a class taught at Camp American. And a couple of weeks ago, we did a show where we played a clip from Larry Pratt of Gun Owners of America. That's www.gunowners.org. And Larry is the Executive Director of Gun Owners of America. And he gave a talk on the biblical basis for the right to keep and bear arms. Well, today, he's going to do a presentation on the historical basis of the right to keep and bear arms, and it does contain a question and answer session, and it's rather long, so to make a long story short, I am going to play it right now. It's pretty self-explanatory. Here's Larry Pratt of Gun Owners of America.
Okay. It's a fairly easy segue into this next discussion from what we've been talking about. I want to address the militia concept that the colonists had, which means what that concept was is still the law of the land today, because the words in our Constitution that refer to militia, that use the term, were defined by 150 years of colonial history. Even more important than what some founder might have said 10, 20 years after the Declaration, after the Constitution, after the Bill of Rights, what's important is what had fixed legal meaning. It's not a, because many times politicians do this all the time. They're involved in a proposal, and then it goes through negotiations, and they have to make a few compromises, and there's some adjustments that are made in the language. And they may still have in their mind what they originally intended, but the words that finally get used, hopefully, have clear legal meaning. And certainly at the time of the Constitution, the term militia really had a clear legal meaning. The English had a militia system. It was somewhat more limited than the militia idea that developed within the United States in the American colonies. The English militia had been something that was radical in its time, for sure, and it had been an instrument of Parliament to resist the king's tyranny. But it wasn't thought of as something that was a power that belonged to the whole people. And that's a difference. A select militia versus a general militia. So when we look at the word militia today that's in that Constitution, it helps to understand that there was an actual development of that from England, from that limited select militia that was an instrument of Parliament to a militia that was an instrument of the people ourselves. You can see this as the tyranny of England tightened its grip on the American colonies. A lot of things were happening that were unconstitutional. Brits have never had a written constitution as we have, but they did have a Magna Carta that came out of the early 13th century, where the barons almost literally had their foot on King John's throat to get him to sign an agreement on protecting various liberties, particularly a right of trial by one's peers, people like me. I don't get taken to a different part of the country for trial, but people that know me, people that know what kind of work I do, people that are like me, peers. That was a significant check on royal tyranny. Due process. Huge, huge thing. I want to talk before I'm finished, hopefully, about how we're watching that get tossed away in our day. the king was tossing out legislatures that by contract with the colonies had a right to meet. This was something that the king had agreed to in the charters that were given to the colonies, that they would be self-governing. When Patrick Henry made that famous speech of his, "Give me liberty or give me death," it was in a church in Richmond. Why? The capital was in Williamsburg. Today it would be about an hour, a little bit over an hour away on the interstate. Why was he there? Well, because the king had closed down the legislature. And then there was the matter of something that was protected in the Bill of Rights of 1689, something which William and Mary, in order to ascend to the throne of England, had to agree to, had to sign. And in that Bill of Rights was a right to keep and bear arms. Now, all of these things were being violated, and it was that right to keep and bear arms that convinced the colonists who took action that the end was coming, that the line between legitimate government and rebellion by government. And that's a concept, by the way, let me just stop right there. How can the government be a rebel? It's always the people who are the rebels, right? It's always us folks with the pitchforks that are standing outside the castle trying to overthrow it in some kind of violent revolution. And that's why I don't like to refer to what our forefathers did as the American Revolution. Properly, it was an American Restoration. It's easier just to call it the War for Independence, since that's also commonly used. But to use the word revolution might make people think that we were no different from the French. As the French might say, au contraire. Quite different. The king began to put the hammer down on the right to keep and bear arms. He convinced the people of Boston, city people often are easily tricked, that in order to keep the peace, he would register the guns, the General Gage would register the guns, and then they would, let's just store them, and we'll give them to you if you need to leave the city. Right. There was another promise by another lying politician that was never kept. So that bothered the colonists a lot. Then when they saw the banning on the importation of guns and ammo, that bothered them even more. And then the crown began to try to suppress the legally sanctioned meetings of the militia. The militia in colonial America had a 150-year legal history, defining it as individual men with their own personally owned militia firearms. Initially, they would specify blunderbusses, and by the time of the drawing up of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and the Militia Act of 1792, which immediately followed the final ratification of the Bill of Rights, the firearms were defined that you had to own as military rifles. But it was always the idea that the individual American had to own his own military gun, firearm. And if he didn't, he would be fined. The only time of door-to-door gun control that you read about in colonial America was an occasional door-to-door based on suspicion that men were showing up at militia without their own guns. And in order to make sure that the gun they said was theirs was hanging over the mantle, so to speak, was to go door to door to check it out. Now, of course, if the government goes door to door for guns, it means they're trying to steal your guns. So a little 180 there over the years. When the militia suppression effort was occurring, George Mason, founding father, a friend of Washington, and a great defender of the Bill of Rights and the Second Amendment, wrote that we needed a well-regulated militia. Now, clearly, in the context of what I've just been talking about, Mr. Mason was not talking about, we need to have the king control better the militia. The king was trying to suppress the militia, not regulate the militia. And he, in fact, Mason went on, just in case our modern ears still have trouble getting wrapped around the concept, he went on to say the well-regulated militia represents the embodiment of the power of the people. What Mason was talking about was you and I are the sovereigns. We're the boss. We created the government. We, the people, do hereby ordain and establish, the preamble of the Constitution starts out. And that means the government is our creation. We're the creator. The creation is always supposed to worship the creator. Does anybody think right now that our governments worship the creator, either in heaven or here on earth? To ask the question is not to pass the laugh test. It's just a preposterous notion. Okay. The debate also went back to Romans 13 that I mentioned earlier. Romans 13 begins by saying that all souls are under the higher authorities or power, as some translations have it. And I think the idea probably to our understanding is more of higher authorities. And the kings would look at that and say, well, that means you all got to bow and scrape before me because I'm the higher authority. What a pagan thing to say. No man is the higher authority. No man. The higher authority clearly is God. The magistrate is to be a terror to the evil and a comfort to the good, being defined by the higher authority, the scripture. So the only way that a king could say he was the higher authority is to say that he's not got a soul, because the passage begins, all souls are all people. So he would have to deny his humanity to make the statement, which would be a ludicrous thing to say. So any which way you look at it, it's a stupid thing to say that some man or men are the higher authority. And it's a rebellious statement, and that's why our forefathers looked at George III as the rebel. Now, obviously, he looked at us as the rebels, but one of us was right, and he was wrong. And he knew where his trouble was coming from, because he would refer to the regiment he feared the most as the Black Regiment. And that's because in that day, and really since the early part of the Reformation, Protestant clerics wore black cassocks, robes. And that was the Black Regiment he feared, because they were preaching the proper understanding, the biblical teaching of Romans 13. The government is under higher authority. The government isn't on its own. This means that you have a country made up of people who, ultimately, it can only continue to function if they are governed by the Holy Spirit. They are successfully self-governing people. And that's why self-defense is so important, because it means that we understand that we have that responsibility, and that we're not just creatures of that phony higher authority. In fact, that so-called higher authority is actually our creature. This is hard for folks to get their mind around in our day. We put out a news release one time accusing President Clinton of being in rebellion against the Constitution, and a newspaper editor wrote back just thoroughly perplexed and amazed that anybody would say that somebody in the government was in rebellion. It just doesn't fit inside their head. I had a debate one time on CNN International right on the eve of the British passing their current gun control law, which has virtually disarmed the entire country of legal guns, not entirely, but no handguns, no semi-automatics, only double-barreled shotguns for farmers and single-shot rifles for target shooting. The British pistol team has to go over to Belgium to practice shooting pistols. That's how draconian, how complete the gun control law is in England. Well, I was debating this parliamentarian, and I gave him a quick lesson in the research that we have developed in this country over the years. One of the leading researchers in the impact of guns and crime, guns on crime, is John Lott. And John Lott has done an enormous amount of statistical evaluation of what various things might impact crime, race, amount of money, density of population, sentencing. Actually, there is some correlation with, you know, the cop on the beat. If there is a presence of the police, that does correlate to lowering crime somewhat. But the biggest impact is people being able to carry guns on them in the street. And so his book, after all this statistical analysis, which is actually somewhat complex, is called More Guns, Less Crime. So when I told this to the Brit, a conservative, it was the Conservative Party that banned the guns. Not that the Labour Party wouldn't have done it, too. His reaction was, oh, I say, anybody who would say something like that over here, he's really quite flaky. And I said, I know you would say that. That's why we're no longer British. We gave up that concept. We rejected that concept. We don't believe that you can protect us, or, as Charlie was posing yesterday, nor will you. If we're disarmed, then we've really got a problem. And the whole reason for the people being armed is to protect ourselves from the government. So even if John Lott's research didn't exist, and in fact somehow guns were associated with higher crime rate, which they're not, but even if that were the case, we need our guns to protect ourselves from the government. Al Capone, the Crips and the Bloods, the MS-13, you pick a criminal syndicate, they have killed nothing compared to the governments of the last century, the bloodiest century in human history. A researcher at the University of Hawaii, whose name just went out of my head, has written a book called Death by Government, and he has shown that the figures, he has dug, the millions that were killed by Hitler, Stalin, Pol Pot, Mao Zedong, who was the greatest murderer in all of human history, came to something like 275 million people, virtually the population of the present United States, dead, piled up, bleeding, never to produce another thing, never to love. And that's what these people did as a matter of policy. They did it on purpose. We shouldn't have our guns? That's an absurd statement. No matter how irresponsible the average American might allegedly be with his gun, he's nothing to be feared compared to people in power who have no opposition. Because that's the way the human heart is. It's desperately wicked. Who can know it? Now, it wasn't just our determination, and it wasn't just our access to firearms that led America to victory, although those were very significant factors without which it wouldn't have happened. But as Marvin Alasky points out in one of his books, it's a clever title, but it talks about defending liberty. He found that the British were so rotten to the core at that time, they were so perverse, They were so interested in pursuing their own heterosexual and homosexual affairs that they had neglected the buildup of their own Navy. And so when our citizen army, when our militia produced battles in the South that bogged down and ultimately turned north to Yorktown, the British armies, where they ultimately lost and surrendered, the reason they surrendered at Yorktown was because they couldn't get resupplied from British ships because there weren't enough British ships to bust the French blockade. And the British ships hadn't been built up because orders hadn't been signed, hadn't been given, because the people in the court, around the court, were so self-possessed with pursuing their own pleasures. And Alasky describes it just short of improper description, but it was pretty bad. You realize that the Brits also contributed greatly to our victory. But we wouldn't have known that. We wouldn't have known that it wasn't an act of just futile defiance to take on the world's greatest army. We wouldn't have known that we could win unless we tried to do the impossible. That's the core of the American spirit, and it was led by a deep faith. Maybe not so much among some of the founding fathers. They were beginning to kind of have a foot in both camps in their way of thinking, Christian, but also kind of interested in the Enlightenment ideas coming through John Locke and Adam Smith and, you know, conservative people. I'd rather have pagans like that in charge today. It would be a whole lot better. But it was decidedly a foot in both camps. But often the soldiers would go to battle crying, "No king but King Jesus." They knew what they were fighting for. It was real clear to them. And that's ultimately why we got the victory, because we were seeking to be on God's side. And that's always the best place to be. Now, in our time, we obviously are facing a government that has really gone way beyond George III's. George III couldn't control the educational system because it was almost 100% done at home. And the main textbook was the Bible and other books that were just dripping with quotations and ideas derived from the Bible. A little hard to develop a tyrannical mindset or acceptance of one through the schools when the schools aren't teaching that. The parents weren't doing that. And even when they would hire it out to a local lady for teaching several of the kids, you can bet they knew what that local lady was teaching. There was real local control. That what I would say is our biggest challenge today is to regain control of education and return it to the way it was in substance and perhaps even in form at that time. And we're beginning to see that. We're beginning to see a pushback in that area. We've even got a candidate running for the United States Senate in Nevada, of all places, who, among her many positions, is elimination of the Department of Education in Washington, which is a fabulous idea, but it seems almost radical in a country and in a time that is so conditioned to letting the teachers do it. They're the professionals. We get that same "they're the professionals" idea about, we'll just call 9/11 because they're the professionals. Yeah, they may be professional, but they're not here alongside of me. You know, so please, don't give me that. We're beginning to see, though, a pushback against all of this incredible, cancerous growth of really all government in this country, but especially right now we're able to focus on the federal government. And words that were not taught in law school for years and years and years and years are now re-emerging as a battle cry. And they're in the 10th Amendment, and they say pretty much to this effect that any power not delegated to the United States under the Constitution nor prohibited to the states is retained by the states or the people respectively. And so the idea is a delegated power is primarily one that you will find listed in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. There are 18 different things that the Congress is able to do. And if it ain't there, they can't do it. Now, they are. That's because they're in rebellion. Of course, they learned that from the church, because the church hasn't taken the Bible seriously, so why should politicians take the Constitution seriously? That's just only fair, right? But the states are beginning to act on this. The first example was about 15 years ago when the state of New York didn't want nuclear waste stored in its state, and it told the feds, you can't do it. And they used the 10th Amendment as their mainstay argument, and most law schools don't even teach it, and they teach it, mention it as an anachronism. You know, we still have it, but it's really from the past, so that's the opposite of anachronism. It's out of date. And nobody, you know, the living, breathing Constitution idea, if you ever hear somebody say that, you have just listened to a tyrant or a wannabe tyrant. If the Constitution keeps evolving, who makes it evolve? How does that happen? Now, the Constitution provides for lawful change. And probably most of you have already studied that. It takes a supermajority of the Congress and a supermajority of the states. But what they're talking about is having, ultimately, nine politicians who dress themselves in a black robe called Supreme Court justices evolve the Constitution. In other words, what was legal today will not be legal tomorrow, and too bad for you, we're going to punish you for legal activity yesterday. That's happening a lot in our courts. It's a terrifying thing to face the money and the power of government and be accused for something that was legal when you did it. But they're making law on the fly, and if they prevail in your case, it will be illegal ex post facto, back to the time. That is tyranny, and we're living under a soft tyranny right now. So the states have finally begun to say enough. The first enough occurred following the New York State dust-up. The big one, really, that started the current 10th Amendment movement off, I think, was the passage of a law that said that our driver's licenses had to conform to national standards and be available for electronic embedding of all kinds of personal data about us. Well, when you talk about that to a gun owner, he gets pretty nervous because he knows what governments do to abuse data like that, and just the ability to steal your ID and go on a shopping spree at your expense is another big downside of that kind of technology. And so enough states, at least a dozen when the straw broke the camel's back, I think, said, well, our bureaucrats will put them in jail if they send you the information you want. We are not complying with your law. And that act called the Real ID Act, it's an acronym for something, has never been taken off the books, but it's never been put in effect. And the sanctions that were in there never were exercised. The states nullified in a major way a law passed by Congress, which is the way the system is supposed to work. They take the same oath of office to uphold, to protect the Constitution under God. And so they would be doing something wrong if their conscience tells them, I don't see that in the Constitution. And then to go along and comply with it. The Congress passed a law against political speech, the McCain-Feingold Act. And it went to the president, Bush. And he said, well, I don't think this is constitutional, but I'm going to sign it and we'll let the courts decide. What? They're the supreme legislature? That's an act of rebellion. He had an obligation to veto that on his own words, he said. By his own words, he knew that that was unconstitutional. Another example now of 10th Amendment pushback against this raw exercise of federal power, which is, by the way, the only alternative to doing what we did to George III. So this 10th Amendment's a very precious thing, and we ought to celebrate it and encourage people to follow it. But the next major example has occurred in the area of firearms. And we now have 8 states that have laws that say, if a gun is made in our state, identified as made in our state, and stays in our state, no federal gun law, of which there are a gazillion, applies in this state to that gun and to its owner. Well, the feds don't like that one bit, and they're already in court on it. And my guess is that the Supreme Court will rule against the states, because the court, more often than not, does that. They rule in favor of the federal government. So here's the deal. It doesn't mean that the issue is over. It's going to depend on whether sheriffs in these various states, at least some, not, you know, it doesn't take every sheriff, say the sheriff where one of the manufacturing companies is located and where they're selling their product, whether the sheriff there understands and is willing to act on the understanding, which is the proper understanding, that the sheriff is the highest law enforcement authority of whatever county. He's the man in his county. That includes FBI, state troopers. He's the guy. I'll give you an example of how this hopefully will work in the Firearms Freedom Act arena. A few years ago, not that long ago, there was a fire in a rural county outside of Memphis. The barn had a lot of ammo and powder in it, so it was a, you know, something that the whole county fire department was out there to deal with and contain. And there were even a couple of sheriff's deputies there. And somehow, onto the property come a couple of FBI agents. And in an all-too-typical way, they announced that they were there to take over the investigation. The sheriff's deputy said, "What investigation? What are you talking about?" "Well, there's ammo and powder involved, and we're here to take over the investigation." Well, they knew one thing very well about their sheriff. He was not a fan of federal extension of unconstitutional power. He was so jealous of his own that he would not take any federal law enforcement money, which they're always doling out to local police departments and sheriff's departments. And when the money goes out, it's like a hook in the mouth. You know, when you read about populations being taken away from the Northern Kingdom, there were hooks put in their nose, and that hook was connected to the next person's nose hook and so forth. Anybody trips, of course, that's kind of a bloody mess. And so you tend to do whatever the person wants you to do with that hook in your nose and your mouth. And the sheriff wouldn't have anything to do with that. So knowing of his attitude, they called him and explained what was happening, and he was out there in a flash, and upon corroborating with his own ears what his deputies had told him, he said to the FBI, "Look, I don't think you should be doing this. And if you insist, I mean, I can give you some office space in my building in town, but I don't think you should be doing this." And they said, "Well, that's fine, but we're just going to continue doing the investigation because we're in charge." And the sheriff said, "I don't think I explained myself clearly. What I was trying to tell you is that if you don't," and he put it rather colorfully, "but if you don't get out of my county right now, you're going to be in my jail downtown." Oh, they were in a huff. "You don't talk to the FBI that way." So they went and called their supervisor, seeking an opinion on what they should do now. And the supervisor said, "Well, a sheriff can do that. Now get the article, A. Not that sheriff. Any sheriff can do that." And knowing that sheriff, he probably will. So they left. And you know what? The county fire department handled the fire. And look at all the money we saved because we didn't have to have a federal investigation. It was a win-win. That's what a sheriff could do. So in my hopes, and I hope it's not a dream, I hope it's a realistic hope. Faith is the belief in things not seen. That there'll be a manufacturer that locates in, you know, Bean Blossom County, whatever, and it's probably going to be a little bit of a rundown town, economically distressed. So hopefully he'll find some office space for his manufacturing operation or sales department about a block down the street from the sheriff. And when the inevitable visit from the men in blue occurs from Washington, you know how bank tellers have that little button underneath their ledge? Well, this guy's about to face a criminal act, so he presses that button, and the sheriff comes busting down the street from a block away and goes through the same routine as the rural Memphis sheriff did so many years ago. And that is the way the federal government can finally get it through its head. Another example I'll give you about the 10th Amendment, because it's probably about the will. The Second Amendment's about the means, and both are completely essential to the defense of liberty. After the passage of socialized medicine, Obamacare, three states responded. Their legislatures were still in session and passed legislation saying, not in our state. And there's a particular mechanism where the feds are instructing states to set up a, what's called an exchange, but a list of acceptable insurance companies that people, and only which from people, can buy. And those states have said, not in our state. Now, the feds had a provision, in case the states didn't do it, that they would do it themselves. But the three states that took action specifically direct their authorities not to allow the feds to do what they would have to do in order to carry out compulsory health care purchases of the approved policies. That probably can win in the court, because pretty much the same court just a few years ago, 15 years ago, give or take, ruled that it was in the case of the Brady Law. And the Brady Law is unconstitutional in a number of ways. The target was the waiting period that was the initial part of the Brady Law. For 5 years, the chief law enforcement authority of a county or a city, sheriff or a police chief, was instructed to do a background check during a 5-day waiting period. And a number of sheriffs said, nuts. And two of them, Sheriff Prince of Montana and Mack of Arizona, took this thing to the Supreme Court. And they won. Because I think it's in Article 2, it says specifically in our Constitution that no official of the United States may direct an official of a state to do anything. Now, they get around that by bribing the states and offering money, and then once that hooks in the nose, they bloody well do anything they're told to do. But in the case of these sheriffs, the bribe wasn't even on the table. And so they won. And that's the precedent that's going to very likely produce a victory for the three states that already have this law, and the many others that I think will add the law to their books in the next year. And there's something about strength in numbers. It was about a dozen or so states that produced that initial victory for privacy against the national ID card. The feds realized that we can't fight the whole country. If it's just one outlier, they can either ignore it or suppress it. But a dozen or more, and right now we're talking about half the states, I believe, are party to one or another of the lawsuits against Obamacare. That is a lot of opposition. And whether the feckless politicians in Washington ever manage to defund it, say the Republicans get control next year, the proper thing to do is, and they know they'd have a veto, which they probably wouldn't have the votes to overturn, but they can put a zero in the budget for the implementation of Obamacare. And if they do that, all well and good. But if they don't, the states are very likely to continue standing in rebuke of Washington. And that's all well and good. The states are a lot more, state governments are a lot more accessible, as out of control as many of them have been, than the Congress. To get to see a member of Congress, you either have to spend a lot of money to go to a campaign fundraiser or luck out and catch him in a hallway, which is not very likely. Otherwise, he's got a staff like a fence around him. But in some of our states still, they don't even have offices, let alone a secretary or a researcher. So you figure out what hotel they frequent, where they stay, what restaurant they go to. You can bag them. And if they're in the state house, there's nobody there to protect them from you. And even in the more professional, and I use that word in a derogatory fashion, legislatures, they're still more accessible. So there's hope that the states are beginning to, the legislators there are beginning to sense that there's an earthquake coming. It's kind of, I was looking at Chilean television, and they had some footage after the earthquake of a TV station, and it was a dog lying on the floor, and all of a sudden this dog shot up and ran out of the building, I'm sure. Then you could see the building start to shake, rattle, and roll, and then the people came running by the surveillance camera, but the dog had this sense. It literally had his ear closer to the ground, like these state politicians. And I think they're beginning to get it. Not well yet. It's still fuzzy. They haven't quite got it all together. But they're going to see it before the feds do, I'm quite sure. One encouraging thing that has happened is the understanding that I've laid out for you of what the Second Amendment means. That it means a militia of individuals who own their own guns are the militia. And the law at the time meant it wasn't optional. So if we had a proper militia law today, it would be like the Swiss. Got to be there. Got to come when called. Bring that machine gun. By the way, the Swiss send their soldiers home with their machine guns, their battle weapons. And you know what country has the lowest murder rate of any in Europe? Switzerland. So having guns is not exactly the bugaboo that a lot of people would have us believe. The Supreme Court took up the Second Amendment straight on in a decision on what's referred to as the Heller case. Dick Heller took the District of Columbia to court because he was denied a permit, because that's what the law in the District of Columbia did. You can't have a handgun under their old law. And if you had a long gun, you had to keep it locked up in a safe. And if you took it out, even for self-defense, you were committing a crime. I mean, how... You talk about a coup d'etat against the people, against the sovereign, right there in the capital city. And that they would put up with that shows that there's a bunch of drones that live in the District of Columbia, and they're the ones that populate our government offices. They really believe that the government should be the first, second, and last word always. Well, Mr. Heller doesn't think that way. And by the way, he works with a gun. He's a security guard in the federal government, part of a private service that contracts. But when he goes home, no guns for Dick. So he took him to court, and he won. And as far as the ruling went, it was a good ruling because it said that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to keep and bear arms. And it actually made reference to some of this history that I have laid out for you. The problem with the ruling wasn't so much the courts as with Mr. Heller's attorney, with whom he became very disillusioned because the guy acted on his own and acted according to his own beliefs rather than the wishes of Mr. Heller. And that's very improper behavior for an attorney. If he really can't stand working for his client, he should have him as an ex-client. But he shouldn't represent his own views. You don't get justice if you can't get some professional to do it your way. So the attorney was asked if he thought that there could be reasonable infringements of the Second Amendment. Now, the Second Amendment reads, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Tell you what, I've read that thing a few times and I just recited it verbatim, 100% accurate. And did you hear the word reasonable in there at all? That's a lawyer term for the living Constitution. Reasonable has no fixed meaning. Reasonable is how I feel about something, not an objective standard. Unhappily, the attorney said, yes, I do. And one of the follow-up questions was, well, do you think it would be a reasonable infringement to require licensing before you can own a gun? Yeah, I wouldn't have any problem with that. That was the ball game. You may be familiar with New York City. New York City has a licensing scheme. It says you can get a gun. Lots of luck. Because it is so difficult. Oh, I'm sorry. You almost had it right this time, several months in, but you abbreviated here and you should have written out. I'm afraid you're going to have to start all over. That kind of chicken stuff is exactly what they do. And now that the outright ban has been overturned in the district, that's what they're doing in the district. A reporter decided he'd find out what it was like to get a gun in the district. There's an approved list of handguns. How's that? The employee's telling the sovereign what kind of handgun he can have? Hello? So he went after a permit for one of the approved handguns. And about 6 months later, and around $600 less in his pocket, he got the permit. Now, he's a reporter. He was at work. So every time he went down to the district office, you know, he was on the clock, as they said. He was getting paid. This is a ban by another name. Licensing, whatever reasonable means, is not a reasonable infringement. That is apparent. And, of course, as we argued in our brief before the court on Mr. Heller's case, shall not be infringed is the standard for reasonable. No law dealing with guns at the federal level, period. It's just so, you know, what part of shall not be infringed don't you understand? And we had a fairly, we reminded them what happened when George III overlooked that understanding of the right to keep and bear arms. That was a pretty gutsy thing for our attorneys to say, because you're not supposed to talk to their excellencies in that fashion. That was obviously a veiled threat. Well, that's what the Second Amendment is. It's a veiled threat. You get out of line and the guns are coming out. It's the only thing people out of control can understand. People say they're out of control. That's baloney. Think of this situation. There's a couple having a knockdown, drag-out argument. Just cussing each other out, screaming at the top of their voice. Phone rings. One of them goes over, picks up the phone. Hello? They darn well can control themselves. It's just that they don't want to. So we got to make them want to. That's what the Second Amendment is all about. Now, when we lobby, we take that understanding with us as we go. We don't figure that the other side's going to be nice, because the other side is at war. They declared it. A lot of guys on our side haven't got that memo yet, and they don't act appropriately. They keep trying to conduct an armistice operation when there's an active hot war going on, not with bullets, other than Waco and a few places like that, but mostly it's just the extension of unconstitutional exercise of power. And this is our big disagreement with the National Rifle Association. They operate pretty much with the philosophy that nothing ventured, nothing lost. That is certainly not the attitude that informed our founders, who took on what looked like a really futile task, taking on the most powerful empire of the day and a pretty substantial detachment of their army present on our land. And so I'll give you an example of how this plays out. Recently, last year, Dr. Coburn, a United States senator from Oklahoma who really would rather be delivering babies than working with his colleagues, and he has made that clear in a book he's written, took the initiative as the head of the Second Amendment caucus in the Senate to put a measure up as an amendment on a bill that was considered must pass. It was one of the president's many socialist bills, and I won't bore you with those details because it's not relevant to the subject, other than in the Senate you can do that. It doesn't have to have anything to do with the underlying legislation, and in a hostile Senate with a hostile president and a hostile House, the only way you can really do it is what Coburn did. So he came out with this amendment to take away the Reagan-era ban. Reagan's Interior Department had put a ban on having guns in national parks, period. And Coburn's language, which is now the law, as of February of this year, says that whatever the law of your state is in which the park is located, that's the law for guns in that park. So there'll be a few states where that doesn't really change much, but there's a lot of states where that makes a huge difference, and you can protect yourself from a grizzly bear or a rapist. And NRA tried to keep Mr. Coburn from putting his measure forth because they didn't have a good feel for the count, who was going to vote yes and who was going to vote no. Well, I'll tell you, we didn't have a vote count. And the main reason we don't think too much about vote counts, think of them, is that, I know this is a newsflash, kids, but this is a new one for you. Politicians lie. And what they'll do when you're trying to find out who's going to vote which way on a pending matter is that those who are against you but don't want to show the folks back home that they are, they're going to try to fake you out. And so they're going to blow smoke and, I don't know, this, I have my problems with this. So what, that, you have to put that guy down as a no in the vote count. But if you force the vote, a recorded vote, which win, lose, or draw, unpleasant people like Gun Owners of America can then use against you in the next election, well, then you're going to vote right. And that was what was going on. And it frustrated Coburn no end. He defied the NRA, put it through, and then as it was going back to the House for their approval, they tried to water it down there. Now, he was so ticked that when we had a banquet for him in Tulsa to honor him, he went through what I've just told you now, and he said, as far as I'm concerned, GOA is the only gun lobby in Washington. So the idea is, if there is a war going on, you'd better act accordingly. And too many of the Republicans, too many of the lobbyists, and it's not just the NRA. It's just, I happen to know in detail about their particular MO, but this is a very common shortcoming among the freedom fighters, if you will, in our town, in Washington, is that they are trying to make a deal rather than to... What's the objective of a war? Not necessarily to kill every last soldier. It's to take away their means and their will to fight. And if we make deals, all we do is tell the opposition they can keep pushing. We're not really serious. It emboldens them. And so what we have to do is, even if we're going to lose a few, we have to go into that legislative arena and tell them no. And the Republicans all too often are mortified to be called the party of no. Well, that's exactly the point Charlie was making. We want the party of no. We have to zero out a huge amount of yeses that are illegitimate yeses, and we need a whole bunch of no's. So that's the way we approach our lobbying, and that's the issue as we understand it. I don't know how much time we have for any... Well, okay, so can we... You want any questions or just... Okay.
Mr. Pratt, in a lot of states, they say that it's okay to have a gun if you have get a concealed carry permit, and they justify this through safety. They say that this is a safety measure for the citizens. But if you're caught, if you don't have a concealed carry permit and you want to carry a gun, can you legally or can you fight it in court if you use the Second Amendment as a justification for that, or do you have to? Do you have to? Is a state this extra layer of regulation just another violation of our Second Amendment rights?
At the moment, because of the Heller decision's ruling, in fact, the court gigged Heller's attorney. They said regarding the licensing law on the books in the district, we can't go there because Mr. Heller's attorney took it off the table, said he had no objection to it. So at the moment, as far as the courts are concerned, I'm not saying the Constitution, as far as the courts are concerned, it's unconstitutional for you to, you wouldn't be upheld on constitutional grounds. Now, Heller has another lawsuit aimed precisely at pulling down all of that licensing scheme in the district. And if he were to prevail, and I think he might get a good ruling because of the way Scalia worded his statement, and it was really kind of a poke at that attorney, then we'd go a long way toward what you're talking about. In the short term, before any of that happens at the court, in the court, three states now have laws that say you don't need a permit, you don't need training, you don't need anything. If you got a gun and it's in your purse, it's in your pocket, on your hip, doesn't matter, you can carry. Alaska, Vermont, and Arizona just added to the list this year. So, and by the way, the answer as far as the argument about somehow this will lead to more accidents, more crime, whatever. These are among the lowest crime states in the country. Absolutely. So, part of it is because they don't have anti-gun big city mayors like Mr. Daley of Chicago, Mr. Bloomberg of New York, where the citizens are unarmed and the crime rate is spectacularly higher than it is in Vermont, Alaska, and Arizona. The best thing is if you're carrying without a permit, make sure you are carrying concealed. Then there's no issue. Any other question or comment? All right. Well, as soon as you're old enough, if you're in this state, that's 18, go get a piece.
That was Larry Pratt of Gun Owners of America. If you want to learn more about Gun Owners of America, go to www.gunowners.org. Now, if you want to learn more about Camp American, how to attend, how to buy some of the videos or audios of some of these classes, go to www.campamerican.com. That's Camp American with an N. And fish around. We have a store. There are slots left open in camp, so yes, you can still get in, but it's closing fast. With that being said, join us again Monday for another Principles and Policies.